We've had quite a lot of commentary and on-the-ground reports from Ukraine on Sunday morning. After the unsuccessful first phase of its attempt at invasion, Russia has now centralised its forces. It's created a unified command structure in place of the disparate moves it was making previously. It's narrowed its territorial focus and it still outguns the Ukraine forces. Although come June or July, when the new munitions from the West are more fully deployed, the situation will be less uneven, say commentators. But what then? This morning we have opinion out of the world's oldest defence and security think tank, the Royal United Services Institute in the UK. It's also Britain's leading military think tank, and it uses intel from Western intelligence officials and former employees in Russia's strategic industries and diplomats and contacts inside Russia, etc. Dr. Jack Watling is its Senior Research Fellow for Land Warfare. He and a colleague have recently published a paper, Operation Z, The Death Throes of an Imperial Delusion. Good evening to you, Jack.
Good evening, or morning, as it is in New Zealand.
Indeed. Thank you for joining us. What is happening with the Russian military broadly first? I mean, it seems merciful, but scarcely believable that it's failing now even to secure the south and east. Or is the grinding attrition approach working, Jack?
The Russian military is stuck in a bit of a quandary. On the one hand, it has an overwhelming advantage in firepower, and therefore it is able to severely damage both Ukrainian towns and also Ukrainian units when they try and form up. On the other hand, it's chronically short of manpower. And therefore, while the Russians can destroy a great deal, they can't necessarily assault the Ukrainian forces and drive them out. And so what we're seeing is the Russians destroy town after town, village after village, and the Ukrainians withdraw at the point where there's nothing really left to defend, which is a very ammunition-heavy, logistics-straining way to operate. It means that the Russians are not conquering territory that they can exploit afterwards, but they are slowly making headway. At the same time, the Ukrainians are being creative in how they are trying to put pressure on the Russian supply lines to strain Russian logistics and to maintain a rate of attrition that prevents the Russians from being able to build up any kind of momentum.
When you say short of manpower, which of course surprises us with Russia, you basically mean useful manpower, don't you?
I just mean people, trained soldiers. The Russian military overall was just under 1 million troops. They pushed in upwards of around 190,000 troops into Ukraine. But this is one of the largest countries in Europe. It's a vast area that they're trying to fight over. And when you look at the heavy rate of attrition that they took in the early part of the fighting, mainly among their paratroops and special forces, so some of their most well-trained and motivated troops, the result is that while they have plenty of artillerymen left, they lack infantry in particular. And they're also running short of crews for particular kinds of vehicle. And so, you know, they're trying to fight a full-scale war against a country that has mobilized its population on a peacetime footing. And unless they shift into mobilization, they are very unlikely to bring their units up to sufficient strength to be able to continue prosecuting attacks.
I'll ask about that prospect. You've been writing about the risks, plural, of Moscow's potential courses of action as the war enters a new phase. What might that phase look like, and what are the risks?
So the Russian system is quite legalistic, which sounds odd given their approach to international law, but the powers of the presidency, if they don't declare war, are limited in terms of the scale at which they can retain and force conscripts into Ukraine, and also their ability to call up reserves. And so unless they do that, declare that it is a war and start mobilizing some of those reserve units, then it's difficult for them to significantly increase manning in the military. On the other hand, once they declare that it is a war officially, in many ways, they lose the ability to define victory however they like. They lose a lot of political flexibility. And it might not work. It might not lead them to have a successful outcome because the Ukrainians are very determined in the defense, and mobilizing lots of relatively badly trained people with old equipment is not a, it's a way of taking a lot of heavy casualties. It's not a way of necessarily, you know, a path to victory. And so the Russian government is looking at two quite bad options, one where it continues to take a high rate of attrition and not be able to make the gains that it needs, and another which is really high risk. It would give it the manpower it needs, but it would also fix it to a set of political objectives that may not be achievable. And so from our point of view, Russian mobilization turns this into somewhat of an existential struggle for the Russian government. And we would consider that the most dangerous course of action from our point of view, because it's clearly an escalation. And so most efforts at the moment are in trying to convince the Russians that even if they fully mobilize, they won't succeed. But there is a flip side to that, which is that the Ukrainian forces are also quite tired, have suffered heavily. And so long as there is that mass of Russian artillery along the border, it's very difficult for the Ukrainians to concentrate sufficiently to conduct large-scale attacks. They haven't had so many troops killed, but they've had an awful lot of people wounded. And, you know, that is a difficult thing to maintain. They also have lost around 40% of their GDP, and they're under economic blockade. Their cities are still being struck. Investment into Ukraine is going to be minimal so long as that's the case. You know, people can't rebuild if things are still being destroyed. And so how they manage utilities, if we get towards the autumn and the winter, when the Russians could start messing with energy supplies, and when so many people in Ukraine will be out of power because of damage to civilian infrastructure and power generation, for example. You know, there are real political issues that the Ukrainians will have to manage as this drags on. The Russian state has the capacity to protract this fighting, but, you know, you have people signing up for short-term contracts at very inflated salaries, and they basically want to survive and get the money. And so the motivation of those troops to put themselves in harm's way is actually pretty low. They firstly had to extract the troops they'd already pushed into the north. And so a lot of their units are very tired and worn out. They're using the same troops. They haven't generated more soldiers. But it also allowed the Ukrainians to concentrate against them, because now there's only really two axes along which the Russians are pushing. And so it simplified the problem set for the Ukrainians as well.
Dr. Jack Watling is talking to us from the Royal United Services Institute, his analysis of what's happening in Ukraine. Putin is still struggling, it seems, to motivate the populace and is characterising the war as now as a life and death struggle against NATO, with Ukraine, as you put it actually, merely the battleground. Now Moldova, we're told, maybe in the firing line as Russia tries to keep hold of the strings of what were once puppet states. The more general situation sounds alarming, Jack.
So I think deterrence is important, and the Russian military is in absolutely no state to take on NATO. It has threatened all sorts of things, but at the moment it doesn't have enough manpower to take two provinces in Ukraine, let alone confront the largest military alliance on the planet. And so I don't think that the Russians are going to directly confront NATO in that way. If they were to do so, then we would probably see nuclear force posturing as the means by which they could show that they have parity with NATO. But that sort of behavior is mutually apocalyptic, and so it doesn't really achieve anything for the Russians, let alone for the planet. So I think that dimension is fairly stable. What is much less stable is how the Russians might try and essentially generate further economic shocks. They know that Europe is likely entering recession, that Europe is going to be paying very high energy prices this autumn, and that will first affect European industry, but then it will affect households and the ability to heat homes in the autumn. And if the Russians want to exacerbate that pain and fracture the unity of those who are sanctioning and busy giving arms to Ukraine, then creating destabilization elsewhere is one means by which they could do that. Moldova is an option where they have significant penetration and they had planned to annex Moldova anyway. But that prospect of that is now much less likely. So there is a question as to whether they start to try and pull levers in Moldova. There's also the Balkans, where they have significant influence. And then there's the Middle East, where they could cause an awful lot of trouble, where they have significant forces. So they have options. And one of the critical challenges for Western policymakers is to understand how far we can support Ukraine, but also which Russian red lines are genuine red lines, and how we avoid the spillover of this conflict. You know, another good example of where that spillover could start taking us in unpredictable directions is the impact on the cost of grain, particularly into the Middle East, which used to come largely from Ukraine. And so if we see exacerbation of famine in Yemen, for example, or significant malnutrition breaking out in Lebanon as a result of this, then you can see how there can be cascading security problems as a result of the disruption of supply from Ukraine. And so there is an active effort to try and manage those problems ahead of time. Most of the timelines I've just talked about are we're going to start hitting those problems towards the end of the summer and into the autumn. So we have some time to get ahead of the problem, but that's a critical priority at this point.
And we see what's happening in Sri Lanka, for example, with food scarcity, and there'll be a fertilizer shortage to add to that wheat shortage you're talking about. And Europe must now cope with 6 million refugees out of Ukraine. And presumably all this only gets worse as well, Jack, in tandem with inflation. So is there a question about how united the NATO countries stay as well?
Absolutely. I think, you know, people have been really shocked by what's happened in Ukraine. And when they see these events unfolding on their televisions and hear about it on the radio, there is a genuine groundswell of support for Ukraine. But when you have people coming home at the end of the day from work, tired, and they put on the news and it's yet more destruction and misery, what tends to happen is that after a while, people, they don't necessarily stop caring, but they change the channel. They want to hear about other things. You end up getting this sort of weariness in the population. And it's not that they suddenly start looking for propaganda from Russia, but they only really start, they actively avoid news about it. And so they tend to start running into news incidentally in unusual places, which is often where disinformation is placed.
Yes. In the Moscow Times, vacancies seeking experts in wartime mobilization readiness and training on the popular jobs platform Headhunter. So do you think larger mobilization in Russia will now happen?
I'm struggling to see what the alternative is, but the question is firstly when, and the longer we can defer it, the longer we have to prepare Ukraine for the wave that will then hit them in several months' time. And secondly, whether it's a full mobilization or whether it's simply using the legal powers that a declaration of war would give the presidency to partially mobilize reserves and other parts of the force to sustain the current level of force and effort, is both of those tracks are plausible. One is much more dangerous than the other, both for Russia and us. And so some kind of mobilization is very likely, but the exact form that it takes is still to be determined and something that we can potentially influence and should be working to do so. The other thing I would highlight is that we're looking at around 11 million Russians becoming unemployed by the end of the year. And so whether the offer of service and secure pay becomes attractive to quite a lot of Russians at that point is yet to be seen.
As you point out, Russia has options. It has friends or at least countries that will deal with it, because we tend to look at Russia from the West through our lens. But nevertheless, will Russia be ruined by this socially, economically, especially if it keeps going? Is that a given in your view?
Depends what you mean by ruined. If you mean that they will be unable to engage in a great deal of international trade and therefore limited in the prosperity that they can offer their citizens, the choice that their citizens have in terms of where they can travel to, then I think this is a very clear consequence of the conflict. Sanctions tend to be sticky, right? We really struggle to unpick them once we apply them. And so they are probably going to be around for quite some time. They will do significant damage to the Russian economy. However, for those Russians who lived through the 1990s, there is a sense that they refuse the idea of being humiliated again by the West. And Russian propaganda and internal dissemination of information very much blames what happened in the 1990s in terms of hyperinflation and the collapse in the standard of living on the West. They essentially take the view that capitalism is competitive. The West won and took advantage of a naive Soviet Union, then Russian Federation, to economically exploit Russia. And so the question is whether the Russian populace accepts that cut to their standard of living. And if they do so, you know, whether it actually makes them much more dependent upon the Russian government and actually, you know, more closely aligned with the regime. In that sense, it may be sustainable for the Russian regime, even if it's, you know, very negative for the Russian population and for the career prospects of young Russians. Russia can be self-sufficient in food and in quite a lot of other natural resources, and they're guaranteed a certain amount of foreign revenue from exports, certainly for the next few years from gas to Europe. And so, you know, it's not necessarily the case that the lack of economic prosperity leads to a change in policy.
No. And the issue with oil prices is complex, and the situation may benefit Russia. I see its oil revenues are in fact up because oil producers and frackers see this as an opportunity to balance their books. So it is a complicated situation. If Russia, though, mobilizes and eventually overcomes Ukrainian resistance, then NATO will have an aggressive and militarized state on its border, you say. But at what point does Putin now have to worry about his own position, Jack?
I think Putin's always worried about his own position. You know, it's worth noting that he has two domestic security services responsible for his protection with a mandate to spy on each other. And the sense of threat and paranoia is quite evident when you listen to his speeches and watch how he deals with his officials. So there's two sides to this. The first is the level of domestic surveillance in Russia is very high, and it's a very geographically dispersed country. Therefore, it's very, very difficult to organize or plot, because you either have to travel over very large distances or make phone calls, and phone calls are dangerous. And so the idea of a kind of popular uprising, I think, is very unlikely. But the notion of a palace coup, at the point where officials think that Putin is, you know, taking them onto a hiding for nothing and they can't get out of this position so long as he's in power, you know, he's very much personalized the war. That is a plausible trajectory. I don't think we're close to that yet. And the risks of anyone trying to plot that sort of activity within the Russian system are pretty severe, both for the individual and their families. So I'm not suggesting that that's on the cards at the moment. But if Putin continues to lose and have no tangible successes to demonstrate, then, you know, those are possibilities that might arise in the future.
Okay. Two things before we let you go. The Russians have hypersonic missiles. With all the intel brought to bear on war now, which you write a lot about, with precision munitions that can be unstoppable, why haven't the Russians gone after the command centres in Kiev, or even after Volodymyr Zelensky? Is it that they can't find him? Are they holding back? What is your analysis of what the Russians are not doing?
So, you know, people have commented on inaccurate assessments of how the war would pan out among experts at the beginning. One of the reasons why some of those early assessments were off is that they assumed the Russians would do things like strike all the logistics infrastructure and go after, as you say, headquarters and so forth. They have started very recently to strike railways more extensively, but they haven't really done it seriously. And that's been a little bit baffling, because the military logic would have been to do that immediately. The conclusion that I've increasingly come to is that they didn't do it because they anticipated capturing the cities quite quickly. They thought that the Ukrainians would capitulate, and they wanted to utilize that very same infrastructure to be able to move their troops around and run the country afterwards. And so they didn't do that. Once they missed that initial window of opportunity, it became a lot harder for them to conduct that kind of strike, because all of the headquarters were relocated to hidden locations. You know, the government buildings are broadly speaking empty. Zelensky made a point personally of remaining in Kyiv, but the amount of time within which he has, you know, been in a particular building is pretty limited. And he usually only indicates that he was there afterwards. So President Zelensky has taken very sensible precautions to make sure that he's difficult to find and strike in a timely manner. And as I say, much of the Ukrainian state has relocated to safe locations.
We form conclusions just finally as we digest media, don't we, that this war will now drag on in a horrible but orthodox enough way. Are there black swan events still possible, though? Do you sometimes get the feeling this may be a war that is fairly world-changing, not just a war that redraws the map of Eastern Europe a bit?
I think it is world-changing in the sense that, you know, NATO had really lost its sense of purpose and was looking around for problems that it should be applied against since the early 2000s. 2014 should have been the kick, but wasn't. And so we had this situation in which security officials were talking about a threat from Russia, and most countries just wanted to get on with, you know, economic activity and not worry about the military. This is something that can't be ignored. And so we've already seen a significant increase in defense spending in Europe. We've seen Finland and Sweden look to join NATO, which is a real step change in their outlook. And increasingly, that means actually that the United States can pivot away from Europe, because Europe is going to be less dependent upon the United States for its defense in the next few years. And so that aligns quite nicely with UN interests as well. So we're also seeing, of course, how Russia is now very highly dependent upon China for any kind of foreign investment at scale. So if you talk to India, for example, who previously was primarily dependent upon Russia for the supply of its arms, India is now looking at a situation where the main adversary militarily that it faces is China. And it's worth noting that China was taking Indian territory only 2 years ago. But China is also bankrolling its main arms supplier. And so if India were to end up in a war with China, then China might well prevent Russia from resupplying the Indian military. And so that represents a massive shift in alignment potentially for major states all over the world. And the consequences of this will ripple on and on. I think in terms of the situation on the ground in Ukraine, things are fairly stable at this point, and it's quite easy to see the timeframes within which certain eventualities might take place. The greatest black swan event, of course, would be that if Russia did withdraw, which, you know, if Putin wants to end the conflict tomorrow, he can do. There isn't any indication that he's intending to do that, but that that is certainly the outcome that NATO states would hope for and that Ukraine hopes for.
Very good to have your analysis, and also thank you for giving us your time, Jack.
It's a pleasure.
Dr. Jack Watling at 10:30, Senior Research Fellow for Land Warfare at the Royal United Services Institute, the big think tank in the UK.